Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. It's Veterans Day, and today's program features military topics. But up front, the Battle of Gettysburg was fought more than 150 years ago, yet it still offers enduring lessons in military strategy, decision-making, and leadership. Military strategists and educators have studied the battle for the lessons learned by dissecting the complex and under-duress decisions of the leaders in 1863 and how they can be applied today. Joining us is retired Army Colonel Jeffrey McCausland, co-author of the book Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for the 21st Century Leaders. He's also a visiting professor of international security at Dickinson College, the founder and CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, and former dean of the U.S. Army War College. Colonel McCausland, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Scott, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Colonel McCausland, I'm going to start by asking the basic question before we get into the book and Gettysburg. Your definition of leadership.
Yeah, my definition of leadership is the one that Tom Vosser, my co-author, who is a distinguished Gettysburg historian and a military veteran like myself, we discussed that at length, and we determined at the onset we wanted to use one provided by a person we think to be a distinguished leader, that being Dwight Eisenhower. And Eisenhower once said, leadership is the ability to decide what has to be done and then get people to want to do it. And we agreed that there were three reasons why we found that definition appropriate. First, obviously, coming from a great leader, the commander-in-chief of the invasion of Normandy and the U.S. effort in Europe, of course, of all Allied forces. President of the United States for two terms. Historians, I think, treat Eisenhower's presidency a lot better now than they perhaps did when he left office. And thirdly, a lot of people don't realize this, Eisenhower was an educator himself. He was the president of Columbia University from the time he leaves the Army until he becomes president. Second of all, we find that definition succinct. You could get longer definitions of leadership, but that's pretty short. Decide what has to be done and get those to want to do it. And then last but not least, the second half of that definition always intrigued me because you might think if you'd been president of the United States or a five-star general or a president of a major university, that all you got to do is give orders and everybody jumps up and moves out with great alacrity. But what he's wisely telling leaders of whatever stripe is you have to try to get a certain amount of buy-in from the team that you are leading, large or small, if you're going to get maximum performance. Yes, they will respect your position and perhaps do what you tell them, but they will only give it their all if they buy into the direction you define.
And so what Eisenhower was saying and what you're ascribing to is that leadership is more than just being the boss or being the manager or being the superior, that it is to get people to buy in to what you're trying to do, what you're trying to accomplish.
Exactly right. And it's also, I think, two other things are very important. And that is, one is, if you took that definition at face value, you might say, well, gee whiz, you know, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot were great leaders. Did they decide what had to be done? I guess they did. Did they get people excited about doing it? Sadly, in many cases, they did. But the other building block of that, of course, is ethics and integrity and character. And I think if Eisenhower was on the call this morning, he would totally agree with that, but say that's absolutely implicit in a American Western democracy definition of leadership. The character and integrity is fundamental. And then secondly, the leader has to create a climate whereby he can be led or she can be led, and others have the willingness and feel empowered to lead, particularly at opportunities for the organization. In the Battle of Gettysburg, there are several numerous examples where the initiative on part of leaders at lower level, making very important decisions, made all the difference between defeat and victory for the Union Army.
And we're going to talk about that in a moment. The book Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. How would you describe the book?
Well, I describe the book pretty much as the title suggests, Scott. My colleague Tom Vosser and I, as part of this company I run, Diamond Six Leadership, had done numerous leadership seminars on the battlefield. We, way back when I was the dean of the War College, we would take War College students down to the park, of course. In fact, historically, one of the reasons the park was created was to offer a place for officers to have a so-called military staff right. But Tom and I decided that, you know, if we focus on leadership principles and the basic history of the battle, this serves as an enormous classroom for any leader. And we've done that with corporate leaders from all across the United States, and then decided that we were going to take this and then transform it into a book, try to get a wider reach. But in essence, use this battle as a case study to talk about leadership concepts that we think are enduring, whether you're leading the Hebrews out of Egypt or you're leading a corporation today or a military unit at Gettysburg. There are certain concepts and principles that are totally enduring. And finally, of course, it's my fixed belief that if a bunch of people of good intellect had the access to any organization for a few days, they could speak very candidly about how well or how poorly that organization was run. But if they visited the organization when it was undergoing a crisis, good leadership and bad leadership would stick out in bolder relief, because crisis, if you will, compresses time. And in essence, two armies, such as the ones that met at Gettysburg, are organizations in crisis. So therefore, those concepts of leadership, poorly executed or well executed, stick out in much more bold relief because of the urgency of the moment, and therefore, I think, make it a much more instructive period of time. And then last but not least, from an educational standpoint, I firmly believe that people learn, particularly talking about leadership, learn from the power of stories. And the power of stories and thinking about people not unlike them who did heroic things under enormous pressure makes it more instructive, gives it what I call a stickiness that sticks with people after they've departed that big classroom down at Gettysburg.
The Battle of Gettysburg was fought in July 1863, 157 years ago. Are there people you've come across, maybe who, when they first, you know, became part of Diamond Six as for leadership lessons, that thought, There's not anything we can learn from something that occurred 157 years ago. Are there people that have that thinking?
You know, it's funny you should say that, Scott, because that was my first concern when I started doing this, and I found that that was very, very uncommon. But it has happened in a few cases, and these are people who believe that you can segment leadership into theirs. You know, leadership for corporate organizations, there's leadership for government service, there's leadership for religious organizations, there's leadership for the military, that all these things are separated into nice little boxes and separation points. But in every case, when I've had people bring that up, usually at the very onset of seminar, I don't find that enduring. And by the end of the day, I find that they get into it and fully embrace the notion, as I said, that there are certain concepts and principles of leadership that are, in fact, enduring. You know, and I think what's interesting about Gettysburg, if you think about it, almost back to the day when it was fought and thereafter, there seem to be those who predicted that. I always often quote Colonel Joshua Chamberlain, who, of course, was the commander of the 20th Maine. And that particular regiment will do distinguished things during the battle on the second day that ensure that the Union Army is, in fact, successful. Without them, they might have well failed. He comes back to the battlefield in 1889 to dedicate a monument, which is still present on the battlefield to this very day. And he gives a speech. And the last sentence of that speech, oftentimes I read, he says, you know, generations that we know not of, heart drawn to see where and by whom great things were suffered and done for them, shall come to this deathless field to ponder and to dream. And it seemed to me that what Chamberlain is suggesting, just what we're trying to do, that people use this particular historical event to learn things that they can apply in their own lives.
You not only talk about or write about the military commanders, but also Abraham Lincoln. We're going to get into Lincoln a little bit later in our discussion. But let's start with some of those military leaders. Robert E. Lee was commanding general of the Army of Northern Virginia for the Confederate Army. And General George Meade was the commander of the Army of the Potomac, the commanding generals of Gettysburg. What kind of leaders were they?
Well, you know, they were very different leaders, and they were in very different places in their leadership at that particular moment. I mean, Robert E. Lee was a very well-known military officer even prior to the Civil War, well-known throughout the Federal Army, had been superintendent at West Point, had been widely described for his exploits during the Mexican War. As the Civil War begins, of course, he is offered command of the Federal armies by then General Winfield Scott, who was sort of the chief of staff of the Army back in those days. Then Lee turned that down to go south and fight for his home state, the state of Virginia. He'll have been in command of the Army of Northern Virginia by the time we come to Gettysburg, about 18 months. And he's been very, very successful. You know, he has won every battle except for Antietam. You might call that a draw. And in May of 1863, of course, he nearly destroys the Federal Army at the Battle of Chancellorsville. And in the aftermath of that, of course, there was a major strategic meeting of the military and political leadership of the Confederacy in Richmond to decide what to do next. And it's Lee's urging that they invade the North, that they invade Pennsylvania to seek a decisive battle on Union territory that he thinks might tip the war, which persuades the Confederate leadership to do that option. And there were other options that we could discuss if you wish. So he begins doing that with that regard. But he then, in many ways, is an icon to the people in his particular organization. He has been so successful. He is, by age, somewhat older than the commanders who are his immediate subordinates. And many of them had been younger officers when he was a senior officer in the Federal Army, or in some cases, had even been cadets at West Point when he was superintendent. Jeb Stuart, for example, had been a cadet and knew Robert E. Lee when he was superintendent. So he's an icon. On the other side of the coin, there's George Gordon Meade. Meade has only been in command of the Union Army on 1 July 1863 for a grand total of 3 days. On the 28th of June, a rider will show up at his tent with a message. Meade, who was a corps commander at the time, thought in his diary, supposedly wrote down, "I thought I was going to be arrested." The rider would say, "No, sir, it's worse than that. You're not being arrested. You're actually being promoted and being made commander of the Federal armies as they're trying to catch Robert E. Lee heading north." His predecessor, so-called General Fighting Joe Hooker, had been relieved or had resigned, and there's arguments about that, by Abraham Lincoln just prior to the battle. So now Meade takes over. Now Meade is commanding his peer group. Several of the guys who are corps commanders, and there are 7 corps commanders in the Union Army, by their date of rank actually outrank Meade. So he's in a much more difficult position. So Robert E. Lee, you have at Gettysburg the icon, and George Gordon Meade, you have the guy leading his peer group in very different positions. Both very experienced. Meade had been a federal officer in the Army prior to the Civil War, but both in very different positions.
So let me just follow up on that. So Lee as an icon, does that mean that those who are under him don't question his decisions maybe as much as what they would someone else that they were a peer with? And then with Meade, because he was closer in age and was a new commander, that he had to prove his leadership skills.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you look at the immediate subordinates to Robert E. Lee, and he has 3 corps commanders plus Jeb Stuart, he has Richard Ewell and Ambrose Powell Hill, who have just been promoted from being divisional commanders to being corps commanders, which is an exponential leap in their leadership responsibilities. I would argue moving from organizational or operational leadership to strategic leadership positions. He has Jeb Stuart, and as they're moving north, of course, Jeb Stuart will go off on this long-term raid. And for about a week to 10 days, as they're moving into enemy country, Robert E. Lee has no idea where Stuart is and is consequently deprived of an awful lot of intelligence. So even though he was very close to Stuart actually in many ways was a mentee, Stuart is hardly a guy in that environment who's going to tell the boss what the boss doesn't want to hear. And then there's Peter Longstreet, who Lee would refer to as his old war horse, who is his most trusted lieutenant. And throughout the battle on the 2nd and 3rd of July, they will disagree a great deal about what the Confederate Army should do. Longstreet urges, for example, at the end of the first day of the battle, that they should move to the south, outmaneuver the Confederate Army and move towards Washington, find a good position and have the Federal Army attack them. Lee says, "No, we're going to stay here and attack them tomorrow." Longstreet will protest prior to Pickett's charge that there are no 15,000 men arrayed for battle. Those are his words. can take that position. Lee insists that he, in fact, does that. So they're in a very different position with their subordinates. On the other hand, George Gordon Meade, of course, arrives late on the first day. He's not really present on the first day. He moves forces around the second day to fend off Confederate attacks. But on the evening of the second day, in a small house on Cemetery Ridge, I should say, not far from where his statue stands today, he'll have a meeting of all his corps commanders to decide what they do on the third day, the fateful day of the Battle of Gettysburg. And as the meeting drags on, he will call for a vote, or his chief of staff calls for a vote on whether the Federal Army should stay at Gettysburg and defend, should attack the Confederates, or should in fact retreat. And they take a vote in inverse order of their seniority, so each officer is not in any way, you know, convinced by a more senior position, a senior officer of their position, and they determine to defend. So very different techniques, whereas the evening of the second day, after 2 days of fighting, Robert E. Lee doesn't talk to any of his subordinates in great detail, keeps his own counsel until the next morning when he will ride down the morning of the 3rd of July, find Peter Longstreet, and give him his direct instructions, which eventually is Pickett's charge on the afternoon of the 3rd of July, 1863.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it is a special day on WITF, a day where we raise funds for with the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank and Wise Markets this year to feed the hungry in Central Pennsylvania because, let's face it, there always are people who are in food insecure. This year during the pandemic, that list of people, the number of people who are food insecure is much larger. That will be on tomorrow's program. Our guest on this Veterans Day, retired Army Colonel Jeffrey McCausland, co-author of the book Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. He's also a visiting professor of international security at Dickinson College, the founder and CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, and former dean of the U.S. Army War College. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Colonel McCausland, I'm going to talk about some of the leaders at Gettysburg. Union General John Buford, he basically chose where the battle would be fought on the first day. And as you do through in every chapter, you point out that there's a special section of in each chapter of what leadership skills each of the commanders or each of the military leaders showed. What leadership qualities did Buford show?
Well, Buford showed enormous initiative, and I would call leading the boss. You know, I talk about people lead from where they are, and a leader wants to create a climate whereby he or she can be led. It doesn't do any good if you're the captain of a ship, if somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, captain, by the way, we're 6 inches from an iceberg," that's not very useful. 6 miles from the iceberg, that's useful. And of course, John Buford will be the guy, as you suggest, Scott, who will arrive on the afternoon of the 30th of June, 1863. Will survey the situation very quickly. He can see Confederate elements off in the distance, west of the town, out towards Cashtown, and he looks at the terrain and determines the key terrain being Cemetery Ridge and the Round Tops and Culp's Hill that have to be preserved. So he makes that decision to deploy his forces along McPherson's Ridge, just the west of town, which allows him then to trade space for time. He knows his small cavalry force cannot hold off against an expected advancement by Confederate infantry in large numbers the next morning, but he can trade space for time, fight on McPherson's Ridge, fall back to Seminary Ridge, and if necessary, fall back to Cemetery Ridge. But he sends a message to John Reynolds, a Pennsylvanian, oh, by the way, who is the commander of the left wing of the Union Army, who is advancing quickly towards Gettysburg, and basically says to him the following: "You know, we've seen the Confederates west of Gettysburg. I believe they're here in strength. Get the infantry up here first thing in the morning." Now, at that particular moment, as a leader, you know, Reynolds could have done a couple things. He could have appointed a committee to study the problem. He could have called Buford back, "Let's have a consultation." But no, these two guys trusted each other. Reynolds trusted his subordinate. If John Buford says that's what we should do, that's what we're going to do. And Reynolds would accelerate his movement towards Gettysburg for the infantry, who will arrive about midday on the 1st of July.
But you also use Reynolds as an example of a type of leader. General Reynolds, as you mentioned, a Pennsylvanian, he was from Lancaster. He was offered the command of the Army of the Potomac, but turned it down because he didn't want Washington interfering. Reynolds was killed in the first hours of the battle, and probably, when you read your book, should not have been in the place he was or doing what he was doing when he was killed. You use that as an example of another type of leader.
Yeah, exactly right, Scott. But it's really more of a choice. I really want people more to think about what Reynolds was doing, because in the 21st century, I think at times we discount one of the most important things a leader has to think about when his or her organization is in a crisis, and that is their physical presence. Where do they go and who do they talk to? Because we can think, well, we got this marvelous technology. I'm talking to you right now through Zoom, or we could email or fax or text or whatever. But still, human beings, I think, interact, particularly during crisis, in that direct relationship. And so that really is the question, where should Reynolds be? And when he's killed, you're right, he's killed there at Herb's Woods. There's a monument to where he was killed on the spot. He is basically commanding about 300 soldiers in a Wisconsin regiment, plugging the line, saying, forward, men, forward, for God's sake, drive those people out of those trees. And he is the only man on horseback in a field full of soldiers on foot. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that's an officer. And obviously that's what a Confederate marksman did when he shoots John Reynolds, and Reynolds is shot through the head and is dead, most people believe, before he even hits the ground. But he's commanding those 300 guys when also he has overall command of 20,000, the entire left wing, three corps of the Union Army. And so the question is, as a leader and your organization is a crisis, where should I be? Some people would interpret what Reynolds would do as micromanagement. I find young people often do that. Other people would say, well, that was a critical moment, an absolutely existential moment for the organization, and that's where he would be. Others say, no, at that moment, he needs to be the guy maintaining the big picture, maintaining the large view of the organization, and take actions in that vein and empower others. So it's really more to get people to think about that particular choice and how, even though we have all this technology, the presence of the leader is crucially important, particularly when the organization is under stress.
But that Reynolds, and I have to admit, I've in all the times I've studied the Battle of Gettysburg, I've never heard Reynolds described as a micromanager.
Yeah, but you could certainly suggest that. And I do that, again, to make people think, because this book is to make people think about leadership. And that, and the discussions I've had break down just as you and I are breaking it down exactly this way. That particular Wisconsin regiment had a very capable commander who would, by the way, lose a leg in the battle, would survive and go back to a distinguished career back in his home state of Wisconsin once the war is over. So Reynolds could have just said, hey, Colonel, get your unit in there. But depending on you, plug that particular hole while I maintain this larger view of what's going on and keep all of it, make sure we're not outflanked, maneuver other large forces. But no, he moves right in to make those direct orders to individual soldiers. Obviously, does one recognize and admire his bravery? No question about it. But of course, for the organization, it meant they lost their most senior leader at a crucial moment in this particular crisis.
Who are some of the other skilled leaders in this battle on both sides?
Well, a couple guys that I admire a great deal that you don't hear much about are two. One is a guy named Gouverneur Warren, and one is a guy named Strong Vincent. Gouverneur Warren is an engineer, advisor to General Meade. He is a staff officer. Therefore, he only has command over his horse and a couple lieutenants. But he is sent up on Little Round Top by General Meade on the afternoon of the 2nd of July to determine, is there anybody up there? He gets up there and finds there's only a signal detachment up there and realizes this particular piece of terrain really anchors the southern end of the Union line. And, of course, Peter Longstreet is conducting a massive assault through the wheat field and peach orchard and is basically crushing the Union 3rd Corps and advancing close to Little Round Top. So he sends a message out to try to get one of the Union commanders who are rushing to reinforce the 3rd Corps there in the Peach Orchard to divert part of their forces to Little Round Top. That message is intercepted by another Pennsylvanian, oh, by the way, a lawyer from Erie, Pennsylvania, by the name of Strong Vincent, whose orders are to go to the wheat field and reinforce General Sickles in the Third Corps. Now, he can ignore Warren. Warren has no command authority over him whatsoever, but they knew each other. They had a personal relationship, and Vincent realizes, A, if Warren thinks this is a good idea, it's probably a good idea, and his quick assessment of the situation suggests by the train it's a good idea. So he violates his order, showing enormous initiative, and moves his brigade, which includes, oh, by the way, the 20th Maine and Joshua Chamberlain, up on Little Round Top, where they defend and hold that very crucial piece of terrain. You don't hear about Strong Vincent because in the defense of Little Round Top, he is, in fact, killed in the fighting and it is therefore largely not heard of, though there is, I understand, a high school in Erie, Pennsylvania called Strong Vincent High School. But if Vincent hadn't made that decision as a junior leader and shown that initiative, we would have lost at Gettysburg.
And, of course, Chamberlain, I don't know, he's taken on legendary status since the movie Gettysburg came out in the early 1990s when men were outnumbered and were out of ammunition, and he decided to tell them to fix bayonets and charge down the hill. But you also use Chamberlain as an example of great leadership. But I want to go on to another leader here. You mentioned the Peach Orchard. General Dan Sickles. He moved further forward than he was ordered to, exposing a Union flank. And you were talking about Longstreet. Is that an example of poor leadership at Gettysburg?
I would say so, because if you look at it from the military standpoint, what, in fact, Sickles does is by advancing forward, he creates a bulge in the Union line. So he can be attacked on three directions at any given moment, number one. Number two, he creates a gap between the northern end of the Third Corps, his unit, which is at the very end of the Union line, and the unit that is just north of him. So there's a gap that the Confederates could exploit. And, of course, the Third Corps just gets crushed in the process in terms of massive casualties in the wheat field and the peach orchard. But you could say Dan Sickles does one thing well, which Strong Vincent didn't. And even though he loses a leg at Gettysburg, he survives the battle, is carried off the field, smoking a cigar with his leg strapped to the stretcher, and goes back and will write up about his exploits, identifying himself as a hero, will eventually be awarded the Medal of Honor and will go on to a distinguished, though somewhat controversial, career in the United States Congress.
Yeah, and charged with murdering his wife's lover. And just a whole lot of other things. He's a colorful figure, that's for sure. Want to move on to November 19th, 1863, Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. In the book, you describe, and I don't know whether you used these exact words, but in so many words, you describe Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as classic leadership. What do you mean?
What I mean by that in terms of classic leadership is a leader determining a particular moment whereby he or she needs to convey a strategic vision, or in Lincoln's case, a revised strategic vision to the organization. We can think about revising the vision, the direction for our organization all we want to, but then we have to figure out when is the right moment to communicate that. And Lincoln determines, I think it's at Gettysburg first. Second of all, you know, he organizes those 272 words in a fashion that any leader can use. I don't care how big an organization or how small they're using. They can organize their thinking when they're talking to their team about the vision for their organization. It really is broken down into three parts. Where we've been 47 years ago. Where are we right now? Met on the battlefield of this great war. Where are we going? We're going to a new birth of freedom. 47 years ago, if you do the math, takes you back to the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, which Lincoln believed was the foundation of our democracy. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Where we've been right now, we're on this battlefield, this great war, it is right and proper, we should do this. And then where are we going to a new birth of freedom? You know, up until that particular point, the main purpose, the vision for the war was to preserve the Union. That's what Lincoln will talk about in his first inaugural address. Even the Emancipation Proclamation does not end slavery. It ends slavery in the states under rebellion, which does not include Maryland or Kentucky or Missouri or Delaware. And some would suggest legally, once the war was over and once those states returned to the Union, they should get their slaves back. They would no longer be under rebellion. But what Lincoln, I think, is doing in the Gettysburg Address is he is now announcing the vision for the purpose of this war now is twofold. Certainly to preserve the Union, that has not changed. But that is now inextricably linked to the ending of slavery. And you'll see him carry that on into the election of 1864 on a plank of ending slavery as something he will run on, which many of his advisors would argue with him throughout 1864 is a losing proposition. But he insists on it until he's reelected. And of course, then we have the 13th Amendment in the spring of 1865, which formally ends slavery in the United States. We achieve that vision of a new birth of freedom.
You also talk about Lincoln's second inaugural speech and why that is shows his leadership abilities as well. Why?
Well, because when you go to the second inaugural, it's March of 1865. They had inaugurations in March back in those days. Obviously, it's done on the steps of the Capitol. There's a huge crowd present. And one, if you think about that for a moment, just reflect on the fact that probably every person in that crowd at that time, because of this terrible war, 600,000 plus Americans have died. Everybody in the crowd probably had lost a son, a father, a brother, an uncle, a friend in the fighting, or had one that was grievously wounded in the process. They knew they were winning the war. Things are going pretty well around Richmond. Sherman has already been to Atlanta, been to the coast, and is heading north. So they're winning the war. There's no two ways about it. Consequently, Lincoln could have strode to the platform basically and given a victory speech and said, you know, once this war is over, I'm going to hang Jefferson Davis right here. I'm going to hang Robert E. Lee right here and gone right down the list. And my guess, Scott, is a lot of people in the crowd would have said, you know, that works just fine for me. Thank you all very much. Okay. We look back and a great deal of reconciliation today, but this has been a horrible war. There is no two ways about it. But what does Lincoln say? Lincoln says, with malice towards none, with charity towards all, let's bind up the nation's wounds. He talks about bringing the nation back together, back to that vision of preserving the Union. He talks about the end of slavery, but preserving the Union is what he is all about, talking about a vision of hope and optimism moving to the future. There are photographs that some historians suggest that on the portico above where Lincoln is speaking is John Wilkes Booth. And after the speech is over in the days that follow, of course, Booth will determine that he is going to assassinate Abraham Lincoln, which sadly he does on the 9th of April, 1865. And as a consequence, that vision that Lincoln articulated is not fully realized, we all know, until we get into the 1960s and even today in the civil rights movement.
Mm. We're almost out of time, Colonel. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We're getting a few calls about what's happening today. In fact, let me just ask you one. I know you have been critical. You've written op-eds critical of President Trump. We have a listener wants to know, I'm interested in your guest thoughts on the current changes in civilian Department of Defense leadership.
Well, I find it very, very worrisome, Scott. Before I do that, I want to do one thing real quickly, and that is to a great shout-out to all veterans. I should have said at the onset, Scott, what an enormous honor it is to speak to you and to this group of people on the radio on Veterans Day. So a shout-out to all those veterans. I find it very worrisome, frankly. Mr. Esper, who was Secretary of Defense, the number three and the number four in the Department of Defense have now been removed and replaced. We're seeing a wholesome changeover in the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense at a critical moment. Presidential transitions are difficult times. There's always a concern that one of our adversaries might take advantage of this moment of transition to take advantage of it. No matter what transition you talk about, that is always a concern. Certainly this one when we've had a very controversial election in many, many ways. One could only imagine, it seems to me, there would be three reasons why in these last 60 to 70 days, it seems to be the last 60 to 70 days of the Trump administration, you'd replace these people. Either one, that you found they had committed malfeasance or they were totally incompetent. There's no evidence of that, to my knowledge. Number two, you're being vindictive. You believe they have not fully supported or been as outspoken as they should be in being loyal to you, particularly over issues such as this use of the Insurrection Act in deploying federal troops against demonstrators, which Mr. Esper did oppose the president on. And that, to me, would be very worrisome because it does seem to be the case. And the only third reason that you would make this particular decision in the waning days of your administration is if you were thinking or planning on doing something that you were confident these particular senior officials would oppose. So you're putting people who are extremely loyal to you first and perhaps the nation second to affect that. That to me would be completely irresponsible.
I want to thank our guest for being with us today, retired Army Colonel Jeffrey McCausland. The book is Battle-Tested Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. He also is a professor of international security at Dickinson College, former founder and CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, former dean, U.S. Army War College. Colonel McCausland, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott. It's been a great pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Just over 30 years ago, the country of Iraq invaded Kuwait, their neighbor to the south and home to 8% of the world's oil reserves. The U.S. responded quickly by assembling a coalition of 35 nations and deploying over 500,000 servicemen and women to the region as part of Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. In recognition of the veterans in the Persian Gulf War, the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle has opened its newest exhibit, This Will Not Stand, the U.S. Army's Road to Victory During the Persian Gulf. Joining us is retired Army Colonel Jeff Mangelsdorf. He is the director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center and Education Center. Colonel Mangelsdorf, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to be back with you and Smart Talk and to kind of share some thoughts about our newest and latest exhibit on Desert Storm. You know, it's kind of impressive that here we are on Veterans Day in 2020, and it's tough to realize that Desert Storm was actually 30 years ago.
I know.
A huge operation that involved over 560,000 soldiers deploying literally halfway around the globe into Saudi Arabia initially to repel the Iraqi invasion into Kuwait.
We are also joined by Molly A. Bompain. She's the curator of arms and ordnance with the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Ms. Bompain, I'm glad to have you on the show today, too.
Oh, thanks very much, Scott. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the exhibit itself before we get into talking about the Persian Gulf War. How did this exhibit come about, Colonel Mangelsdorf?
Well, so we have a regular rotation of exhibits, and this thing has actually been in the planning for quite some time, knowing that we wanted to link it to the 30th anniversary. And it's also appropriate because, as you know, Scott, we are part of the Army War College, an integral element of it. And so as the Army shifts its focus away from small-scale contingency operations towards multi-domain operations and large-scale conflict against near-peer competitors, it's appropriate that we revisit Desert Storm, because it was the most significant undertaking of the Army in recent history, where we literally had to mobilize a significant number of troops against an adversary that at that time was probably the fourth largest army in the world, equipped with state-of-the-art Soviet equipment. And so as we look to the future, it's appropriate that we study the past in preparation for that, because there's likely to be important lessons there that are relevant for our War College students, as well as the greater public as well.
When we talk about the first Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, I don't know, 30 years later, I don't want to say it gets forgotten, but it doesn't get the kind of attention that subsequent military actions have, like the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, even some of the smaller military engagements. Why is that? Is it because it was completed in such a short time, or was that kind of confusing or cloudy ending to it? Why do you think that is, Colonel Magelsdorf?
That's a pretty good question, actually. A lot of people have studied it. I suspect that that it's a combination of a number of things, one of many of which you've touched on, Scott, which is it had a rapid conclusion. And it's a false lesson that many people have learned that this 100-hour war was easy. And it's one of the things that that Ms. Molly Bompain tries to evoke in some of the interpretive panels and displays throughout the exhibit, is that this really, yes, the duration of combat was very short, but this was the culmination of probably 15 years of effort and preparation, which is why it went so quickly.
Ms. Bompain, let's talk about that. I mean, when I think back to the first Gulf War, I think of General Norman Schwarzkopf. I think of terms that were used for the first time, like shock and awe. I remember leading up to the military action that, you know, as Colonel Magelsdorf mentioned, that the Iraqi army, fourth largest in the world, that there were a lot of warnings that this would not be easy and we'd be bogged down. How does the exhibit show exactly what happened during that period?
Well, you know, we don't start the exhibit on August 2nd, 1990. We look back into the collection and we try to bring to the audience that this established presence in the Persian Gulf with the U.S. Army. We look back to World War One and the peace talks and when the Middle East is cut up and how that is a determining factor in Saddam's, how he regards Kuwait. And then we look at the Persian Gulf Command, and then Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, and the multinational force and observers, and the exercises that have been going on in Sinai, like Exercise Bright Star, to establish this idea that the Army has been here, and the different exercises and training. And then we look at the different changes, you know, post an Army coming out of Vietnam, and all the changes in doctrine, in material, that led to such a successful ground war. And I think in one thing, you know, having been in college and watching this, you know, in the dorm room in Thurston Hall unfold, people forget the anxiety that the American people had that this was going to be another Vietnam. Like how big, I mean, we were afraid of Iraq and we were afraid of their firepower and, you know, the vaunted Republican Guard. And it's easy to forget all that because, you know, because it was so quick. And that's what we wanted to bring to life in the exhibit and then highlight it through different soldier stories because, you know, as Mr. Magelsdorf said, we have over 500,000 U.S. troops deploying to Saudi Arabia. And so this vastly different experiences by different soldiers and what that was like and what the 9 months of deployment or a year, however it varied from division to unit, but what they felt and what their experiences were.
You know, something that you just brought up is something that we Americans, not you in the military, but we Americans often do, is that we don't take the long view of, you know, when, you know, people, if there probably are a lot of people who, when they heard we were going to be talking about the Gulf War today, they thought of that short period of time when it was over so quickly, when what you just described, going back to World War One, that brings context to what happened in 1990 and 1991. And it is very instructional and educational for people to think back on that context of what led to this. But something else you just mentioned, and again, I remember this well, that this is probably, it was the largest military action that the United States had taken since Vietnam. And Vietnam scarred so many people that you're right, that it just showed that there wasn't a lot of confidence going in. Would you agree with that?
I do. And I think everyone was nervous because, you know, as an American, with the perspective from the American public, you know, you don't see all these like these successful decisions by chiefs of staff of the Army and, you know, from the ground up, from the soldier level, all these decisions implemented, all this equipment being being tested and trained, training centers being built up, and the evolution of an all-volunteer Army. And then you bring women into the story and it changes the dynamic, and then you have a force that's victorious. So and it's hard too, Scott, because a lot of our visitors, you know, this is 30 years ago, you know, some of our staff, they're not even 30, you know, and they don't remember it. And it's kind of sometimes written off because it, you know, is something that was simple, when the complexity is really what is interesting, and how the ground war, the air war, how it unfolded, how it was executed. It's a fascinating story. And then when you get into the individual soldier story, I mean, it's like it reads like a movie, you know, they talk about it very freely, like they didn't do anything. It's not a big deal, but it is. And Scott, I have to tell you the one fascinating thing about Desert Storm, and you would talk about the amount of troops, but just in casual conversation with people, you mention it and they say, oh, I was there, my dad was there, you know, my mom was there. And then it's what we talk about of this collective memory, you know, for the United States military, and that's shared by so many. And the fact that we have so many veterans that are alive and can participate, enjoy it, and re-engage this conversation, I think is just an opportunity of a lifetime.
We only have about...
It really is something special, you know, Scott. Molly touched on it, which is while there was 500,000 soldiers directly involved in the operation, so too were there that so many more families and relatives and friends of those soldiers. At that time, the Army was a much more diverse representation of the populace. And as you touched on yourself, Scott, this was the first major combat operation since Vietnam. I mean, yes, there had been Panama, there had been Grenada, but those are very small scale operations, almost raids, if you will. There'd been the failed Desert One attempt to rescue Iranian hostages. So this was the first real time that our nation had been put to the challenge of deploying an army this large. And that really impacted a lot of lives across the country.
So, Colonel Mangelsdorf, what do you want a visitor or someone who's going to come to see the exhibit? What do you want them to take away?
Well, so that's a great question, because there's so many different things, right? So one of the challenges that Molly and our expert curators face when they build an exhibit like this is we're trying to talk to many audiences all at the same time. So that's a significant challenge, to put together an exhibit like this one that has lessons that are appropriate for graduate level education students at the Army War College, as well as for 10-year-olds and their friends to come through and pick up a different set of messages and lessons.
What about the trail?
So that's one of the things that I hope people would come across and recognize as they come through. But in the end, there's maps, there's diagrams, there's things that explain how the things unfolded. But more importantly, I think, is the personal aspect of this, and that yes, there were large arrows on maps. We've got that too. But war fighting is really a personal endeavor, and we can never forget that as a nation. And so many parts of the exhibit, so many of the display cases evoke and present that experience from the individual that was there. It's not just the general's war, it's the private's war as well. And those messages come through pretty well in the exhibit, and I think people really will enjoy seeing that as they come through.
The exhibit, This Will Not Stand, quoting President Bush, the first President Bush, the U.S. Army's Road to Victory During the Persian Gulf. The exhibit opened yesterday at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Retired Colonel Jeff Mangelsdorf, Molly Bompain, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Thanks, Scott. It's always a pleasure to join you.